really, really grateful to be with you here today. I'm so excited to have gotten this opportunity. My area of research really tries to tackle big questions in life. You know, things like meaning, why are we religious, humility, you know, things that you're supposed to talk about at parties, right? That in politics. So when I got the invitation, I thought, well, goodness, this seems kind of right up my alley. So I want to just start off with a note of gratitude, saying I'm very, very grateful to be here. Recently, for the past 6, 7, 8 years, I've been studying why people are leaving religion. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about this process of religious change, but I'm going to also contextualize it with another line of research I do around humility. And so I figured I'll go ahead and give you the big idea now so you can decide if you want to pay attention or quietly doze off. So here's the big idea I'm hoping to present, that facing existential questions with humility is a pathway to flourishing. So facing existential questions with humility is a pathway to flourishing. So we're living right now in a time of considerable religious change, something that I call the Great Disillusionment. And so a lot of sociologists and people who are conducting large-scale polls have noted that in the past 30 years, the percentage of, let's say, Christians have dropped from about 90% to about 63% in the past 30 years. By 2070, many predict that Christianity will no longer be the majority of religion in the U.S. One in three Christians will leave the religion by the time they reach age 30. And it's not just Christians that are leaving their religious upbringing. All religious affiliations in the United States are on a decline. And so you might have heard of the rise of the nuns. So these are not the people wearing the black with the rulers. Okay, so the rise of the nuns is when asked, what's your religious affiliation? They say, well, none. I don't have any religious affiliation. About 3/4 of the religious nuns are actually religious duns. That's what we call them, the religious duns. So they're people who have left religion. They walked away from religion. Now, why is it that they left religion? So my colleagues and I have conducted research. We've looked at other people who have conducted research. And we've come up with 4 reasons why people are leaving religion. We call these the 4 horsemen of religion's apocalypse. So 4 reasons why people might be leaving religion. So the first is what's called cultural stagnation. So people are getting more progressive, but their institutions are stagnating. So if you ask them, why are you leaving, they may say things like, well, I outgrew my religion, or they may give intellectual reasons, or they may say, my church wasn't affirming of LGBTQ folks, and I am, or my church was too fascinated with the patriarchy and sexism and issues around gender, and that's not me. Yeah, so one reason they leave is cultural stagnation. Second reason why people leave is because of religious and spiritual abuse and trauma. So whether they have personally experienced this at the hands of leaders or by their religious people or through religious means, or they've witnessed it from afar, they've said, this is a moral hypocrisy that I don't want to continue to endorse, so I'm stepping away. A third reason why people leave is what I would call simplistic views of suffering. So one way of thinking about religion is it's a way of making a story around human suffering. So if Buddhism is all about making sense of life as suffering. Okay, chronologically, the first book in the Christian Bible was Job. Okay, so this is a book about a guy and like all these terrible things happened to him. And he's like, why is something bad happening to me? Right, so religion is kind of a story about why does suffering happen and how do we make sense of suffering? Now, oftentimes when people encounter suffering or adversity, if they're relying on their religious beliefs that taught them, well, everything happens for a reason, and good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people, that's a great belief to have when nothing bad is happening to you, right? Because what does that mean about you if good things are happening to you? You're a good person. Now, what happens when bad things happen to you? It must mean we can't psychologically handle that. So something starts breaking down, right? And we start asking ourselves, you know, if everything happens for a reason, what did I do to befall this tragedy? So, and what underlines all of these religious beliefs are what scholars call just world beliefs, right? That life is fair. So people are leaving because they just can't make sense of tragedy. And churches or religious teachings have failed to develop rich enough, thick enough conceptualizations for why suffering exists and how to navigate that. And then the fourth reason why people leave, and I think this might resonate a lot with this this group and the community, although maybe, you know, I'm guessing here, is something called a problematic label. So people no longer want to identify as religious or a particular religion because of all of the meanings and connotations associated with that label. So for example, I think, just based on hunch and evidence, that since 2016, the word evangelical has taken on a different term. Right? So there was a poll in 2022 that 40% of self-identified evangelicals do not believe in the deity of Jesus. Now, I'm not a religious scholar, but I'm pretty sure that was the central component of what it means to be evangelical. So what this is suggesting is that for at least two-fifths of self-identified evangelicals, it's more of a socio-political term than it is a religious one. So many people are saying, if that's what it means to be religious, that's not me. Okay, so this is why people are leaving. So what does it actually look like to leave religion? And I promise this is related to humility. I will get there, I promise. So to leave religion, we think of religion as having four components. Cognitively, it's things we believe. Emotionally, it's the ways in which we relate to the transcendent. Morally, it's how we shape our lives. And socially, it's the communities in which we spend our time. So people might leave religion not only by no longer identifying as religious, but changing what they believe, changing whether or not they have an emotional connection with the transcendent, deciding whether or not they want to continue following religion's moral laws, and then what they do with community, whether they disengage or engage with a different type of religious community. Now, after people leave religion, one of the starkest things that we find is something called religious residue. Okay, so religious residue is this idea. After you leave religion, religion is sticky and it sticks around with you. Okay, and some of you are like, oh yeah, that's right. So we've done cross-cultural research. So everything I'm sharing with you is all based on empirical research. So if you want to show me later or find me later, I can, as the kids say, I can show you the receipts, right? I can point you to the empirical findings. So we did a study in the US, Netherlands, Hong Kong, New Zealand, United Kingdom. So this is cross-cultural work. After people leave religion, they're still more likely to think, feel, and act religiously than people who have never been religious. And so if any of you right now are going through religious change and you're like, wow, it's really hard to leave religion, that's because religion's not leaving you. Okay, religion is really sticky. And the reason for that is cognitively, it's the lens through which we see the world. Behaviorally involves a lot of habits and rituals that are really hard to break. And socially, if we're ever embedded in social communities that are still religious, it's gonna bring up all those religious feelings again. So we know that religion is sticky, we have this religious residue. We also know, though, that after leaving religion, during a liminal phase, okay, so when people are like, oh, I think I'm leaving, we compared those who no longer identified as religious and were still practicing religion versus those who no longer identified and were completely discontinuing with religion. Any guess as to who the mentally healthier folks were? Oh, you're like, I don't know, I don't trust him. What's he gonna say? This is a trick, right? So when I share this research in churches, like active practicing churches, they're like, oh, the still practicing people, they're the healthier ones. They're actually not. So people who have left religion or de-identified from religion and who are still in religious communities, going through all the religious things, they actually have poorer mental health than those who have broken off and completely discontinued. Because you might imagine that for people for whom what you're doing no longer matches with your identity, that's a lot of cognitive dissonance to deal with. I was at an event. My wife wanted us to go to this gathering of ex-evangelicals in 2019. And my friend was coming from Kansas City. He was out in Denver. I was like, let's go. And I thought we were just kind of going to do this personally. And I showed up, and there were over 5,000 people there. Yeah, so I was like, okay, put on my researcher hat, started taking notes. During a breakout session, I met with a pastor, and he looks over at me and he says, I need to tell you something that I haven't told anyone in this world but my wife. And I'm like, oh my gosh, she's gonna tell me where the body is buried, right? So he says, I don't believe any of this. I'm not religious at all anymore. But I'm too close to retirement to actually come clean, so I'm just going to stick it out. And I thought, that's a huge burden to bear. And I can only imagine the emotional and mental consequences of having to bear that burden. Okay, so that's what it looks like to leave religion. One more thing real quick. We did some research looking at when people leave religion, how are they perceived by religious people, and how are they perceived by people who have never been religious? What we find is that people who leave religion, religious people really like those people. They really do. And when we ask why, it's because they think they're coming back to the fold. But when we ask people who have left religion, who do you like? They like people who have never been religious. But sadly, the people who have never been religious don't like people who have left religion. Yeah, you get it. You got it. The reason why? They can't trust them. Right? So people who have left religion are kind of like me at a middle school dance. The person I want to dance with doesn't want to dance with me. And the person that wants to dance with me, I don't want to dance with them. Right? So people who have left religious are uniquely predisposed to feeling lonely, to being isolated. And so what they do is they connect with other people who have left religion, and they spend most of their time talking about how terrible religion was, which is okay for a time. But as long as you still allow the entity which has brought you pain to define you, you're still being defined by that. And so the important thing is to move past a deficit identity of, I'm not religious, into a presence identity of, well, what am I? Right? What are all of the great things I am? Okay, so this is the backdrop. What does any of this have to do with humility? Religion has been perfectly designed to answer existential questions. So scholars say there are 5 big existential questions. We'll get super depressed real quick, then we'll come back out of it, I promise. Here are the 5 existential questions that all humans have to answer. The first is what's called groundlessness or freedom. We have to make decisions in a world in which we don't know the answers, but we have to live with the consequences, right? What should my profession be? Whom should I partner if I want a partner? Should we have kids or not if we can, right? And then you have to live with those consequences. The second big existential concern is that all of us come into, experience the world, and leave the world completely and utterly alone. Okay, I promised you it was going to be depressing. All of us are having different phenomenological experiences. We never know fully what it's like to be someone else. You're wondering how much more depressing I'm going to get. I'm wondering if my jokes are landing. Some of you are wondering what's for lunch. None of us quite know what it's like to be someone else, which is why we always seek the validation of other people. We say, I need you to see me. Do you know that language? I need you to know me. Because what we're saying is, I don't want to be alone in this world. And if you can see me, if you can know me, if you can tell me I'm right, I'm just a little bit less alone. The third is we have to figure out our identity. Who am I? In the pre-talk, this was great. We were talking about essence, core, soul. Do we have those things? What does it mean? Does it change? How do I navigate my identity? The fourth is, despite the fact we don't know what's right, what the right decision is, we're completely alone and we're not quite sure of our identity, the one thing we are absolutely certain is going to happen is one day we're going to die, right? Hooray! So the realization of our own mortality should be absolutely terrifying to us, right? And that's another fear we have to contend with. All of those things together gives rise to the fifth fear, which is that life may be completely devoid of meaning. And we are living in a careless, cold, uncaring, chaotic, random universe that has no meaning, and we're just spinning around randomly until one day we die. Yes, yay. Okay, so religion is perfectly suited to answer all these questions. You have a supernatural agent that tells you what to do. You have a supernatural connection with the transcendent or divine that makes you feel less alone. You can have an identity in a religious group. Religion probably does this next thing better than anything. It solves the problem of death, right? It's like that Woody Allen quote. I want to make sure. I don't want to achieve immortality through my work. I want to achieve immortality through not dying. I don't want to live on in the hearts of my countrymen. I want to live on in my apartment. Right? So the best that non-religion can do is give us symbolic immortality. right? That we will have memories, that we will be cherished, that people beyond us will remember, that after this, you will go on and on and on, and I will live on by you telling all these other people how great my talk was. Not going to happen. You're going to go eat lunch, go watch the Lions lose, and then, you know, it'll be a Sunday. Hey, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I had you till then. Now he's like, get off the stage. Yeah, I should talk. I'm a Denver Broncos fan. Okay, so, and then fifth is religion provides us with a sense of meaning. And there's some research that suggests that religious meaning is actually more meaningful than other meanings, right? So if you're doing something for religion's sake, it's actually more meaningful. All of those existential concerns should give rise to sufficient enough existential anxiety that we should be absolutely paralyzed with terror all the time. We should be grappling for anti-anxiety and anti-depression medications the size of cantaloupes every morning. But yet we're not. Because what we do is we construct and adhere to cultural worldviews. So cultural worldviews are these systems of meaning that help us make sense of the world and provide us with a feeling of lasting permanence, meaning, and significance. So for many people in the world, and maybe some of you at some point in your life, that may have been religion. If you've left religion, okay, what you face now is what I call the existential chasm. And this is when you're refacing these existential concerns brand new without the structures of religion. But it's very different than if you've never been religious. Okay, so Jean-Paul Sartre has this great story where he talks about he's in a cafe waiting for a friend. And when he's waiting for his friend, it's very different than when he's dining alone. So if he's dining alone, he's sitting by himself, he's eating, he's drinking, he's totally fine. But if he's waiting for a friend, he feels that friend's absence. So if you've been religious and you've held beliefs that used to provide you comfort and you no longer do, you feel their absence. And if you haven't yet developed the requisite skills and abilities to construct this cultural worldview and answers to existential questions, you may be at a loss for how to do that. So my wife is a therapist. You're like, oh, that's how she stays with you. Okay, so my wife's a therapist. She sees a lot of clients undergoing religious change. When they leave, some of her clients have actually said to her, okay, now that I don't believe that, I need to figure out what to believe. What should I believe? And she's like, first of all, I would never tell you that. The second of all, my ethics would preclude me. Third of all, that's for you to decide. Right, so facing these existential questions is the key feature of what it means to be human. So when we feel that anxiety, when we're reminded that we're going to die, when we feel, you know, when we ask questions about the meaningfulness of life, a lot of times what we do is we can get defensive. And we double down on our worldview and we disagree with other people who have dissimilar worldviews. Right, especially if two of us come into contact and there's a situation of epistemic exclusivity. One of us has to be right, one of us has to be wrong. Who do you think's right and wrong in that situation? I don't know, but it sure isn't me. Right, and so what we do is we denigrate them, we derogate them, we put them down. And if that doesn't work, we try to change their mind. And then if they won't change their mind, we insult them, we tell them that, you know, they must be ignorant, and if that doesn't work, we resort to ideologically motivated violence to eradicate them and their beliefs. Because those types of things are so threatening to our sense of existential security. All right, what's a possible solution? A possible solution is engaging these existential questions with humility, with admitting we could be wrong. In fact, we talked about this in the pre-talk. All of us are a little bit wrong about everything. We are. And all of us are a lot wrong about some things. We don't like to admit that. And even as I say that, most of us are like, yeah, I know they are and they are, but good thing I'm not, right? We have to admit we could be wrong. We have to remain open to the possibility that we will change our minds. Because my sense is most of us in here have changed our minds about something really big in the past. It might happen again. So humility and intellectual humility, I would say, is an awareness of the limitations of our own beliefs, what we know, but also what we don't know. It's remaining open and willing to revise our beliefs for sufficiently strong evidence. So believing something until there's sufficiently strong evidence to believe something else. I think that that's a pathway toward flourishing, to seeing those five existential concerns not as fears, but as facts. Okay, we may never know whether or not our decisions are right. I can live with that. I can live with the fact that no one will know what it's like to be me. I live with the fact that my identity will continually change, that death is the certainty, and I don't know what the meaning of this life is. Treating those as truths and not as threats. And in some of the initial work that we've done, we found that what I'm suggesting is really, really hard. We don't like to do it, right? It's why ideologically secure and certain worldviews have such psychological appeal, right? It's why we just want someone to tell us what to believe. We want to know what's right and what's wrong. When you can engage with this type of humility, it makes you a better person to other people. You're much more tolerant. You're able to get along with people with whom you disagree. But here's the flip side of that. It's intrapersonally challenging. It creates more anxiety. It creates more uncertainty. You feel a little bit more psychological dis-ease. But the question remains, is it worth it? Right? For you to engage the world in a more open way, might not it be worth it for us to cultivate what I would call an existential distress tolerance, to admit that we could be wrong, to live with the requisite anxiety that comes with realizing we could be wrong, and then remaining open to revise our beliefs around these core questions about life, because we've done it in the past. Chances are we may do it again in the future. So in my mind, engaging these existential concerns with humility is the pathway toward flourishing. Thanks.